It would be no surprise to any of you here if I told you that life was hard. It might be a surprise to some of you if I insisted that, especially so for the Christian, depending on what you've grown up believing about the Christian life. Some of you may believe that the Christian life is one of greater ease than the unbelieving life, that once we give ourselves to Jesus and surrender our purposes to Him, that He'll make everything a little bit more wonderful. We look to the Apostle Paul and find very quickly here that that is not the case. The Apostle Paul has lived quite a life. He's had his ups and his downs. He's about to embark on a journey that will be one to remember, one for the books. And we're going to study it together over the next 2 weeks. But the Apostle Paul was a remarkable man, having lived quite a life. We recall the details. He was born in Tarsus as a Jew. He, from birth, was a Roman citizen, which would come in handy later on, as we've learned. But he was formally educated in Jerusalem under the best of instructors at that time, one Gamaliel, who provided for him education bar none in the city of Jerusalem. But from there, the Apostle Paul was spiritually refined even further and privately tutored by our risen Lord for 3 years in the Arabian wilderness. That's what he says in Galatians chapter 1, verse 17. Quite an education. Quite a well-rounded education. After that, he was commissioned by the church in Antioch and sent out as a missionary in Syria. He's traveled over 10,000 miles by land and sea, all over the ancient world, the Middle East and Asia, on into Macedonia. He spent a year and a half in Corinth ministering there. He had a 3-year stint in Ephesus. He's been to such places as Athens and Philippi. He has been to the island of Cyprus, among other places. He's a bit of a Renaissance, you know what a Renaissance man is, before the Renaissance. This guy was well-rounded in all things, education and experience, travel. He's cultured, he's sophisticated. He's seen some of the greatest wonders of the ancient world, like the Temple of Artemis, the Colossus of Rhodes. But there's one place that he's never been, yet he's always dreamed of going, and that's Rome. Rome. Almost 4 years prior, he purposed in his spirit to visit Rome. In chapter 19, verse 21 of the book of Acts, he began to express that deep desire of his, saying, quote, "After I have been to Jerusalem, I must also see Rome." He wrote to his friends there shortly after that, telling them in Romans chapter 1, verse 10, "I constantly pray that if at all possible, I could find a way in the will of God to come to you." And here now, in Acts chapter 27, he's on his way. In verse 1, it says that when it was decided that we should sail to Italy, they delivered Paul and some other prisoners to one named Julius, a centurion of the Augustan regiment. "So entering a ship of Adramidium, we put to sea," meaning to sail along the coasts of Asia. "Aristarchus, a Macedonian of Thessalonica, was with us." Notice "we" and "us" has picked up again, so Luke is there also. Luke is the author. "And the next day we landed at Sidon, and Julius treated Paul kindly and gave him liberty to go to his friends and receive care. When we had put to sea from there, we sailed under the shelter of Cyprus because the winds were contrary. And when we had sailed over the sea, which is off Cilicia and Pamphylia, we came to Myra, a city of Lycia. There the centurion found an Alexandrian ship sailing to Italy, and he put us on board. When we had sailed slowly many days and arrived with difficulty off Cnidus, the wind not permitting us to proceed, we sailed under the shelter of Crete off Samone. Passing it with difficulty, We came to a place called Fair Havens, near the city of Lycia. So Paul and company is finally on their way to Rome. Again, he's got Luke, an old friend, and Aristarchus with him as well, another trusted friend who was referred to in another place of Scripture as a prisoner of the Lord, so he probably did jail time with Paul. He's got his friends, he's on his way to his destination, but he's also wearing shackles, we remember. He's a prisoner of the state. He is under heavy Roman guard at the moment, and you got to ask yourself, as he's going off to this dream come true called Rome, if he ever expected it to be like this. I dare say he did not, okay? Psalm chapter 37, verse 4 is one you may be familiar with, where it tells us that God will, quote, give you the desires of your heart, end quote. We love that one. God will give you the desires of your heart. We love this, we cherish this, and we probably should, but has it ever occurred to you that while the Lord certainly does to intend to fulfill every spirit-purposed desire in your life, that he never promised he was going to do it the way that you thought he would or necessarily wanted him to do it? He'll give you the desires of your heart, all right, but do you have any idea what it's going to take to get there? Probably not, but the Apostle Paul knows I'm right when I say that we ought to question that. His trip began on a ship of Adramyttium. That would have been a small, slow coastal boat that would hop and skip along from port to port along the coastal towns of Asia there. Notice again in verse 6, it says that they transferred to a large cargo ship from Alexandria, Egypt. This was a cargo ship carrying grain, we'll find out next week, along with 276 passengers. So this is a much larger vessel. Now, it's a ship from Alexandria, which is in Egypt. Egypt was a major producer and supplier of wheat and grain to the rest of the ancient world. And Rome, the place that they're going, was dependent upon Egypt for their exports. So, this sounds like frivolous details, but the point here is that the Roman government gave special consideration to who ran these ships. They're only going to staff these vessels with their best crew. And I think that Julius, the centurion, knew that, which is why it says in verse 6 that he found an Alexandrian ship sailing to Italy. The word found there suggests that he went looking for one of these. Why? Because in his estimation, these would have been the safest transport possible with the best and most skilled crew. This is safest. Now, if you know where this story is going, you know that there is no such thing as safe or guaranteed safety, at least, in the economy of God. But he's doing his best. He wants to get his crew, he wants to get his cargo, he wants to get his passengers, his prisoners to Rome safely. In verse 9, it says, when much time had been spent and sailing was now dangerous because the fast was already over, the fast was the Day of Atonement, Paul advised them, saying, men, I perceive that this voyage will end with disaster and much loss, not only of the cargo and ship, but also our lives. Now, at this point, the Apostle Paul is objecting to their plan of going any further than they already have. He goes, listen, we've gone this far. I don't think we should go any further. He says, I perceive here that it's neither wise nor safe. And he counsels them to stop in their tracks. Now, the reason is partly because it's late in the shipping season. Luke tells us that the fast was already over, the Day of Atonement. The Day of Atonement, or the fast, usually was finished by late September, early October. Now, the fact that it's already over, we're into October. And from late summer through October, things were dangerous in the shipping world. Because of the weather patterns and the seasonal shifts, this was getting more and more dangerous with every departure. By November 11th, records indicate, they shut down all shipping lanes altogether because it was impossible to sail across the Mediterranean. So they are coming dangerously close. Keep in mind, however, that they all wanted to get to Rome. The captain and his crew wanted to deliver this cargo because if it worked in the ancient world like it does now, you get paid by the load. We got to deliver this. We got to get this in before winter. It's payday, guys. Let's push. Not to mention if you had any passengers on that boat who wanted to get to Rome for business, get back to family, or any other reason, they wanted to get there. The only ones that wouldn't have wanted to go to Rome would have been those prisoners that were awaiting execution there. They might not have wanted to get there so quickly, but everybody else did, and that would have included the Apostle Paul. And I dare say that perhaps Paul wanted to get there more than anybody else. So Paul, listen to me, isn't advising them to stop because he just wants to be mean. Or he wants to throw his weight around as an apostle. He's not doing this because it's in their worst interest. He's doing this because it's not only in their best interest, but also in spite of what he wants, he knows what's right and good. Paul's going, I'm on the same page as you guys. I want this just as much as anybody else. But his discernment was too much to ignore. So he had to speak up. And he did. And I'll tell you, listen to me. I don't think this was easy for Paul. I don't think so. I think it would have been rather difficult for him to stand up in front of the centurion, the captain, the entire crew, and announce, guys, this is what's going to happen if we keep going. You know what that's called? A prediction. He's making predictions now. So you'd better be right, because if he's wrong, that will destroy his credibility. Not only his credibility, but God's credibility, him being the Lord's spokesman. He'll destroy not only his own, but also God's credibility in front of 275 pagans. Well, minus Luke and Aristarchus, what are we down to, 273? He doesn't want to destroy his credibility. Nor the Lord's. So he's standing up. He's really, what we say, going out on a limb. He's taking a risk. He could be wrong about this. What if he's wrong? That's the last thing Paul wants. That's the last thing anybody would want, especially when you're a minister for the Lord and what you're supposed to be speaking is truth. And Paul was a minister. So this wasn't just a hunch. He's saying what he's saying here. Because he was an observant individual. And I'll tell you that throughout this voyage, Paul noticed some things. I don't know if you noticed the same things that Paul was noticing, but they're recorded for us in the first 8 verses. Here are a few of the things that Paul would have noticed. The fact that the winds were contrary in verse 4. I mean, if the winds are contrary in your life when you're pursuing something, it's at that point that you at least... God at least deserves for you to consider whether perhaps you're going in the wrong direction. So at verse 4, Paul is already going, should we be doing this? Nor did it escape his attention in verse 7 that the sailing was unusually slow. Now you add one to the other, things are beginning to accumulate. He also noticed in verse 7 that getting to Cnidus was difficult. He also noticed that the wind kept holding them back. Paul was growing increasingly restless about the situation the further this plan went along. And if you notice, it wasn't his plan, it was theirs. Go back to verse 1. When it was decided that we should sail to Italy, Paul's along for the ride. He never decided this. It's what they wanted. And Paul went along with it. And now he's going, this ain't working, this ain't working, this ain't working. And then, somewhere in between verses 8 and 9, he noticed how the voyage had gone from difficult, that's the word that's used in verse 8, to dangerous. That's the word used in verse 9. So by this point in the journey, Paul has to stop them and say something. He has to. His discernment is going crazy. He has to speak. And I'll tell you this, it wasn't just his discernment either. It was experience. It was past experience. 2 Corinthians 11:25 says that Paul had already been on no less than 3 different ships that had sunk. So he knows why ships sink, and he knows what it looks like when they do. Paul has been through this before. In fact, in verse 10, when Paul says, I perceive, the word he uses, perceive, means to conclude something based upon past experiences. Paul's going, I've seen this happen before, guys. I can't, listen, the wind is contrary. Things have gone from difficult to dangerous. I've seen this happen time and time and time again. We've got to stop. Spiritual leaders are mandated by God to warn. Paul is under divine obligation to say something. When you or I, as Christians, perceive something in somebody else's life to be unwise, unbiblical, or dangerous, the one to whom God gave the discernment, if they say nothing, they are accountable to God for whatever might happen next to the person for whom they were concerned. If you keep your mouth shut at the wrong time, you get in trouble. Did you know that? Ezekiel 33, verse 8 says, if I announce that some wicked person is going to die and you fail to tell them to change their ways, then they are going to die on their sins, and I will hold you responsible for their death. Pretty clear to me. The Lord wants you to speak when you see somebody headed for danger. Paul sees it. He's gone through this several times, and so he does his job. He speaks, and that's all he was expected to do. He can't steer the ship. That's not his job. He can't turn the boat around. He doesn't have that authority, but he can say something when he sees danger. So he does. He was faithful to voice his concern and give his counsel, so any loss or death from this point forward won't be his fault. He's done his job. Verse 11, nevertheless. Oh, great. Nevertheless. Just because wise counsel is given doesn't mean it won't be rejected. So Paul says what needs to be said. Nevertheless, the centurion was more persuaded by the helmsman and the owner of the ship than by the things spoken by Paul. And because the harbor was not suitable to winter in, the majority advised to set sail from there also, if by any means they could reach Phoenix, a harbor of Crete, opening toward the southwest and northwest, and then winter there. Here we're given a little bit of evidence as to why Julius the centurion rejected Paul's advice. And if we pay attention, I think we can learn a little bit about why people, even to this day, choose to reject wise counsel. Pay close attention. The first one here is for lack of trust. Why would somebody reject godly counsel? Because they don't trust the one who's giving it. Again, Paul wasn't the only one speaking into Julius's life at this point. He was surrounded by people, all who wanted to weigh in to the situation, and Julius, in the end, listened to the helmsman instead of Paul because they were the professionals, and Paul was a tent maker. What does he know about sailing ships? What does he know about this profession? What does he know about my life? You might find yourself asking similar questions one day when you receive godly counsel from somebody who doesn't seem to you to have a clue about what you're going through, but based on past experience and based on holy discernment, actually knows more than you might think at the moment. You can reject godly counsel. That's up to you. But there are reasons why it happens. The second reason is godly counsel gets rejected because it conflicts with selfish personal desires. You see, they didn't like where they were harbored at the moment. Fair Havens, don't let the name fool you. It wasn't Fair Havens. It wasn't like some, you know, like summer resort. This was not a good place to be. It was open to the weather. They didn't like it. And so they wanted to leave on that basis alone. They wanted to be somewhere else. In their minds, Phoenix, on the island of Crete, Phoenix would be much better. They have selfish personal desires, reasons why they want to go. It might be unwise, and it might be unbiblical, and it might be dangerous, but they don't care. They want what they want, and they're going to go there anyway. So that's the second reason why godly counsel is oftentimes rejected, because people, in the end, want what they want. So a minister could counsel until he's blue in the face, and in the end, the receivers of that counsel are going to end up doing what they want regardless. Believe you me. And there's a third reason, given right here in Scripture. Third reason is because of impatience. Okay, a long winter was about to begin. Again, this would have lasted from November all the way through March, February or March. A long 4 or 5 months, too long for them to wait. They just can't wait any longer to get on with their plan. They want what they want, and they want it now. Ironically, they're going to lose everything before they reach their destination. We'll read about it. Proverbs 21, verse 5 says, "Everyone who is hasty comes only to poverty." You want to push to get your way before God's time? You want something too soon? God will allow you to have it, and then you will pay the repercussions. I'm sorry to tell you, but that is a binding spiritual law. You will reap what you sow. They ignored Paul's counsel, and now they're going to pay a price. I'm sorry, but when you got somebody like Paul that you should probably trust telling you that they are scared to death, that they would be scared to death to do what you're about to do, you might want to listen. They're going to go ahead and do it anyway. They're going to pay a price. And listen, Paul is going to pay that price with them. You know why? Because when all is said and done, they're on the same boat. They're in it together. Paul is literally sharing life with these guys. And if they lose, Paul loses. If the ship sinks, Paul sinks. They go down together. So Paul's own life is about to get very uncomfortable because his counsel was rejected. And I'll tell you that every minister has felt the pain of this. Rejected counsel. You can't just expect to be in somebody's life and give them good advice and they reject it and you not feel the effects of it. Every minister feels this because once counsel is given and yet rejected, that minister from that point forward has no choice but to sit and watch as marriages fall apart, families drown, and faith gets shipwrecked. There is no escaping a situation like this without feeling it yourself. We all feel it here because you and I are on the same boat. That's why it's imperative that we love each other enough to listen. Will you? Time will tell. In verse 13, it says, "When the south wind blew softly, supposing they had obtained their desire, putting out to sea, they sailed close by Crete." Ooh, it's going to work. Wouldn't it be nice if the sermon was over here? And they all lived happily ever after. They all got to Rome safe and sound. It was just peaceful from there forward. Well, actually, there's more to the story. Might look good for a while, but oh boy, there's more coming. So, but for just for verse 13 and beyond, the Bible here is going to give us a very detailed look at what can happen when wise counsel is rejected. First, nothing. Nothing. They wouldn't listen to Paul. They didn't trust his discernment. Any experience that he had accumulated as a servant of God who traveled land and sea and seen a few things. Well, they rejected the counsel, and at first it seems like it's going to be okay. Smooth sailing. Wonderful. Relief? Relief was probably felt by these guys for the first time in a long time. I mean, the first 8 verses were rough. Contrary winds, difficulty, things went from bad to worse. And they're probably just like, oh, thank God. I mean, nothing like a warm, gentle breeze from the south to make it feel like everything's fine and the right decision was made. When really, nothing could be further from the truth. See, there's a storm that's brewing just where they can't see it yet, and it is about to hit them with cyclone force. Cyclone, literally, cyclone force. In verse 14, it says, but not long after, a tempestuous headwind arose called Euroclydon. So it wasn't long, not long after, it didn't take long, for things to begin falling apart here. They encountered what here is called Euroclydon. That is a particular meteorological weather system that they would have been familiar with, something that we would call a northeaster. But it was a violent wind. It was the most feared of all storms, and it was equivalent to a hurricane or a typhoon. So what began in verse 13 as a hopeful and optimistic departure from Fair Havens quickly became a concerning ordeal. Uh-oh. Euroclydon. Verse 15, so when the ship was caught and we could not head into the wind, we let her drive. And running under the shelter of an island called Clauda, we secured the skiff with difficulty. When they had taken it on board, they used cables to undergird the ship, and fearing lest they should run aground on the Syrtis sands, they struck sail and so were driven. Notice in verse 15, it says, we let her drive. Right? Did you catch that? The ship was caught. We couldn't head into the wind, so we just let it drive. Here's the second stage, or the third stage. First is nothing happens. Everything seems like it's okay. I don't have to do what God wants me to do. I don't have to listen to anybody. I'm free to... Okay, first stage, everything's going smooth sailing. Second stage, a storm blows up. We're at the third stage now where they're, quote, letting her drive. So at this point, there are some concerns. They're starting to feel some real concern, but they're still taking a passive approach to the whole thing. They're letting the ship determine their course. They're not in control of the ship. The ship now is in control of them. We're letting her drive. That means they're drifting. They're going off. Why? Why are they letting it happen? Why do people let this happen when they find themselves getting concerned about their life and it's starting to fall apart? Why do people just let it go that direction? Because they assume it's only temporary and that they will get things back under control soon enough. What do people like that do? Same thing these guys did. In the meantime, they're going to make sure they have a backup plan. So look at verse 16. It says, running under the shelter of an island called Clauda, we secured the skiff. Now it was hard. It says they did it with difficulty, but they got her secured. What's a skiff? A skiff is a dinghy or a lifeboat. It would have been tugging along behind the main ship, just pulled by a rope or a chain. And so what this was if the ship capsizes or sinks, everybody can get away. This was like life insurance for them. And they're getting so concerned that they're bringing the skiff into the boat with them. They're undergirding it. They're strengthening and reinforcing the thing because they're actually starting to realize for the first time that the worst case scenario might end up being our scenario. But for now, we're just letting it go where it wants to go. So they've secured the skiff. And then I want to draw your attention to verse 17, where it's, you know, they're no longer letting the ship drive. In verse 17, it says, they were driven. Very end of the verse. They were driven. So now they've gone into another stage of this disaster, where it has become unmistakably clear that they are not in control like they thought, nor is it likely that they'll ever get it under control, and bad things are happening that they are no longer able to stop. Also notice in verse 17 how the wind is pushing them toward the Syrtis Sands. You say, what's the Syrtis Sands? Well, if you don't know, I assure you, they did. And they are afraid. They are very afraid. It's starting to scare them, right? The whole situation is really starting to scare them. It says they feared. So now they're in a bit of a panic mode. The Syrtis Sands is to be feared because it's an area almost 600 miles in circumference. That's huge. Where, according to online sources, rocky shoals, cross currents, and sandbars exceeding a great distance out made the sea utterly impassable. When a ship driven by wind gets inside, it's impossible for it to escape. Submerged rocks scattered over the greater part destroyed boats. This place is also known as the graveyard of ships. Syrtis, the word, literally means to draw or drag along, to pull in. So they were being pushed by the wind toward a fate that had overtaken so many others. A disastrous fate that had overtaken many others while being simultaneously sucked into it at the same time, no matter how hard they fought against it. Syrtis means to be sucked in. The sands that suck you in. This is like quicksand, ultimately, and many, many died there. In verse 18, we see the next stage in a situation like this. Verse 18 says, because we were exceedingly tempest-tossed, the next day they lightened the ship. Verse 19 is a almost parallel stage. On the third day, we threw the ship's tackle overboard with our own hands. Listen, guys, now they're in survival mode. This is survival mode. They are willing to do anything to lighten the load. Anything, no matter how much it hurts, no matter how much it cost. They're doing things now that they never would have imagined themselves doing a month ago. They left Fair Havens. They never would have thought. Certainly not when they left Caesarea in the beginning. They're just going to Rome. They're just going along in life. And yet everything that they had when they left Fair Havens now was lost. Gone. Sure, the load was lighter, but their lives were empty now. Lighter load, empty life. Anything that might have been of help, anything that was of value, anything that was perhaps of sentiment, gone forever. And it was by their own hands. They had to do it. They had to do it because, again, this is survival mode. And so they have nothing left. And finally, here's where it goes. Finally, they gave up. Verse 20, when neither sun nor stars appeared for many days and no small tempest beat on us, all hope that we would be saved was finally given up. They're done. They're not even trying anymore. They've thrown everything overboard that could be thrown overboard. That didn't work. They've secured the skiff. They're just clinging on for dear life. They're barely alive at this point. They've got neither sun nor stars for many days. That would have been their navigation system. So the navigation system is down. They don't know where they're going. They don't know where they are. They're adrift at sea, no direction anymore. They don't know what to do or where to go from here. They have simply resigned themselves to a life of prolonged misery followed by some inevitable death, which for them, they would have known what it was. It would have been a slow, painful one of dehydration, stranded in the Syrtis Sands with no visible shoreline for even perhaps hundreds of miles. You can't drink that water. You will die. You will die. And no one can rescue you from this because no one can dare to go into where you are to get you out. Your hope for rescue was first announced by Paul back in Fair Havens. You had chances along the way and you ignored them all. And when the council came, you refused to listen. And now, all hope is gone. So these people are totally lost, broken, and dejected. They've got nothing left, and they are hopelessly drifting through each miserable day. And Paul thinks to himself, I wonder if they'll listen to me now. And so in verse 21, after a long abstinence from food, Paul stood up in the midst of them and said, so Paul's going to take advantage of the situation. You know why? Because Paul knows there still is hope. They don't. They gave up all hope, but Paul knows his God, the God that they don't know at all. And so he stands up to speak and says, men, you should have listened to me. And I don't want you to misconstrue what Paul said there as if he's going, I told you so. No. He's saying, you should have listened to me because they needed to understand that they're in the situation they are because they didn't. If it hurts, it's their fault, not Paul's. He has every right to stand up and go, should have listened to me. You should not have sailed from Crete and incurred this disaster and loss. All this disaster, all this loss, all this is your fault. I talked to you, I spoke to you, I gave you counsel. You wouldn't listen. This is on you. And now I urge you to take heart. That literally means cheer up, guys. Cheer up. How can this situation be cheery? How can it possibly be cheery? I'll tell you how, because there actually is hope. And Paul is going to convey hope to these guys now. So there's every reason to cheer up. I know the situation really sucks, but Paul's going, guys, we can do this. He says, for there will be no loss of life among you, but only the ship. For there stood by me this night an angel of the God to whom I belong and whom I serve. He's introducing these people to Jesus Christ for the first time in their life. They didn't know God up until now. And this is what it took. This is what it took for them to have their eyes opened to the reality and the power and the salvific grace of Paul's God. So Paul is still referring to him as his own God, but he says, there stood by me an angel of the God to whom I belong and whom I serve, saying, don't be afraid, Paul. You must be brought before Caesar. And indeed, God has granted you all those who sail with you. Paul's going, guys, it'll be all right. We can get through this. Therefore, take heart, men. Again, cheer up. For I believe God that it will be just as it was told me. So are they going to believe Paul this time? Yes, they will. Why? Because they didn't do it the first time. And look where they are now. Only an absolute fool would go on rejecting what Paul says from here. Proverbs 29, verse 1 says, a man who remains stiff-necked after much reproof will suddenly be shattered beyond recovery. You want to continue to reject counsel now? That's your call. Hebrews 12, 25 says, see to it that you do not refuse him who speaks. If they didn't escape when they refused him who warned them on earth, how much less if we turn away from him who warns us from heaven. It's imperative if you have failed to receive godly counsel and wisdom once to not do it anymore. And I want you to notice how for the first time in this voyage, Paul is speaking of God. He brings up God's name three times as he stands up and he addresses these guys. He says, you should have listened to me, God, God, God. And he tells them that God has granted them life. Here's a question for you. Why didn't Paul speak of God earlier? Why didn't Paul invoke the name of God back in Fair Havens? Maybe if he would have played the God card back then, they would have listened and they wouldn't have got themselves in this mess. Why didn't Paul bring it up earlier? Probably because they weren't ready to hear it. They weren't ready to hear it. They had to go through this in order to embrace Paul's God. And I find it interesting that God didn't even appear to them through Paul until they all quit trying to get across this sea on their own strength and with their own wisdom. Paul goes, are you done? Are you lost? Are you broken? Are you hopeless? Great. Let's get started. So now, at last, they're finally ready to listen. The same Jesus who calmed the wind and the waves in Mark chapter 4, we're all familiar with that, aren't we? Jesus calms, shh, and the wind and the waves obey him. That's the same Jesus who can churn up a Euroclydon if he wants to. It's the same Jesus. He has command over weather, and if he wants to calm a storm, he can, and if he wants to usher one into your life, he can do the same. Some aboard this ship that we call church are going to swim when those storms come, and there will be others who sink. God sends the Euroclydon not to make you into somebody that you're not, but to reveal who you truly and always were. Storms have a way of proving a person's character. So take heart. Cheer up, Paul says. God is with you still. God is with you still. Verse 26, however, we must run aground on a certain island. However, it's going to get a lot worse before it gets any better.